All right, good evening. Welcome back. It's Monday night. Tonight we're going to do part two in our series. Our series is tackling the laying the groundwork for the development of the state of Israel. All of the things, not all of the things, obviously, many of the things that went into creating the state. What is the background of this? We started with the early 1800s last week and the Musar movement, the seeing how the Jewish people were splintered into many different groups. And this evening, we're going to be tackling the story of the Chovevei Tzion, the lovers of Zion, and how that will be, or the groups really that laid the groundwork for it itself, the laying the groundwork for the first Aliyah movement, what's known as the first Aliyah, the wave of Jews that came in 1872, 1873, but there's much that went in, 1882, excuse me, much went in before that, and we'll be taking a look at some of those things tonight. So glad you are here to join in. Let us jump right in. What we're going to be addressing is the shift in the mid-1800s, in world Jewish history, and the scene of Jewish history, and the role that the state, the land of Israel, which will eventually, of course, become the state of Israel, plays in the history of our people. And what I mean by that is that when you look at Jewish history as a whole, there are many characters, there are many different countries which play different roles. And if you were to flip through any book of Jewish history, not every book covers every country throughout every century. Some countries are more central, more important than other countries. Some events are more important. Some centuries are more important. Throughout all of our long history, from the point of the exile in the year 70, until around the 1800s, the land of Israel, as much as it is yearned for, dreamed about, does not play the central role in Jewish history because the Jews simply are not there. There's always a presence there, but the Jewish people are not there. And therefore, when you learn Jewish history and you speak about Jewish history, we speak about the Jews of France and Germany, Spain and Portugal, of course. England has a major role. And then we move to Europe throughout all of the later part of the 20th century, of course. And the land of Israel is always there, but that's not where the majority of Jews live. In the 1800s, there's a shift where onto the scene, the character of the land of Israel, if you were to like view it as a character in a film or in a play, becomes a main character. You cannot talk about Jewish history from the year 1850 and on without it being in the context of the land of Israel. And today, obviously, since 1948, it has gotten far more significant than that even. It is now the central role. Everything that goes on in Jewish history is going to be focused on the land of Israel, and the rest of us are just sort of watching and observing that which is taking place. But the main player has clearly shifted now, and that shift begins at this point in history. It's going to have many forms, many waves, many casts of characters, but the state of the land of Israel is going to be a fascinating drama that is not just going to grip the Jewish world, but really the world as a whole. Literally today, we all woke up to the news, the continuing news story of the assassination in Iran of the nuclear scientist. And I just want to mention it just for one point as we begin this story. So, of course, nobody knows who actually did it. And, of course, we know everybody's pointing fingers at Israel. And as all the news agencies report that Iran is, of course, blaming Israel, they mention because who else has the capability to do that? Who else could have pulled that off? So they sort of like shrug their shoulders like, well, it was either the U.S., or it was Israel. How else could this have happened? Now, I'm not here to say who it was. I don't know who it was. I'm not allowed to reveal that publicly, obviously, tonight. But let's just state as a matter of wonder that we live in an era. We're going to start just talking a little bit historically about some of the things that happened in the mid-1850s. What has happened over the last 150 years or so that we've gotten to the point where when something like that happens, it's a given in the world. Well, obviously, where else could that have come from? That alone is a statement just of the fascinating story in Jewish history of the role that Israel in all of its form plays. And we'll Mirtz Hashem get back to just in putting that into the context of what we're addressing. Let's start from the beginning. The idea of the love of the land of Israel. That idea a love of the land dates way before any concept called Zionism. That dates all the way back to Avram Avinu, as we've been reading about in the parshas that we're reading about in Sefer Bereishis. It is the central tenet of every single believing Jew, that Hashem has given Avram and his descendants the land of Israel. He promised him to have children as numerous as the stars in heaven, and this land will be yours. There's no ands, ifs, or buts. A believer of Torah Judaism believes, loves, yearns for the land of Israel. We have, as an exiled people for 2,000 years, simply prayed, yearned, desired to go home. We mourn for it every year. We break a glass under the chuppah. We conclude every Pesach Seder, every Yom Kippur, Lashana Haba Yerushalayim. Loving the land is part and parcel of being Jewish. That's just the way that is. We can't all be there right now, but to love it, to want to be there, to yearn to be there, it's just part of who we are. And we have a concept called Zionism. That, in its early form, was a political term, meaning a political movement for the return of the Jewish people to have their own sovereignty over the land. And that, as we'll get to, God willing, in coming weeks, was filled with many different meanings, massive amounts of controversy amongst many different factions of Jews. So just to distinguish, and one of the things that we're going to do tonight is distinguish the idea of loving Israel dates way back. The idea of trying to come back dates before, predates Theodor Herzl, predates the movement of Zionism. And many of the movements that we'll discuss tonight will eventually merge into the movement called Zionism and then disappear. But there was much to discuss before we actually get to Zionism. And it's important that we should be aware of the history of some of the things that actually took place before Zionism became a movement. There was always a Jewish presence in the land. From the time of the destruction until today, there was always, always Jews living in the land of Israel. It was a small number of Jews. Between the years 500 and probably 1500, when the exiles from Spain began to come, a minute number, probably that you can count in hundreds as far as how many Jews were actually there. And they had all sorts of difficulties, of course. In the years following destruction, most of the Jews, again, the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, the second one in the year 70, and the Jews are exiled. There's small amounts of pockets of Jews left, but eventually they're all dispersed. Whoever was left, the Crusaders, was a long period of time, of course, beginning in 1096 and lasting for over 200 years. That just destroyed the communities that were in the land of Israel. So that when the Ramban, the great Nachmanides, arrives in the land of Israel in 1267, fulfilling his lifelong dream to settle there. They just redid his shul. Those of you who have been in the old city recently, the beautifully redone Ramban shul, right there in the center of that plaza in the old city. He arrives in 1267. He cannot find a minion of Jews in Yerushalayim. He has to import Jews from Tzfat up north just simply to be able to have a minion in the land. People, Jews, yes. Large amounts, no. That begins to change in the mid-1500s with the exiles from Spain and Portugal. Of course, the expulsion from Spain, which was followed in 1492, followed 5 years later with the expulsion from Portugal. Hundreds of thousands of Jews are set onto the road. Where did they all go when they left Spain and Portugal? So they settled throughout Europe, and of course, many of them made their way to the land of Israel. They settled in two major areas, one in Tzfat and one group in Yerushalayim. That was one of the many periods in Jewish history where the Jews were convinced that redemption is at hand. We could have an entire series of lectures on all the moments in Jewish history when large groups of Jews were convinced Mashiach was about to come. This was one of them. It was just a disaster of an experience, of course, for a large number of Jews. The Jews in Spain had been there for 800 years, prominent, and here they went through this calamity. And if it weren't for the world wars of our century, we would still be talking about that as possibly the greatest tragedy in Jewish history after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And many of them returned to the land of Israel. And that gave them a sense of maybe that was the meaning or the purpose of this. We are always looking as people for meaning and purpose behind our calamities and tragedies that we experience. There was an episode in the early 1530s where Salome the Magnificent had given one of the Jews, one of his officers, like control of the city of Tveria. And many of the Jews took that as this momentous occasion where a Jew was in control of a city in Israel. They literally thought that this was going to be. We spoke about this in the great Smicha controversy, where there were a number of rabbis who tried to recreate Smicha, to actually give Smicha, to recreate a Sanhedrin and a high court, and many other principles. At that point, the Turks are in control of the land, and for more or less, the Jews really did not have a great existence there. They were persecuted and discriminated against. And because it was a group from Spain and Portugal, from that point, from now the 1500s, for the next 200 plus years, the Jews in the land of Israel are almost exclusively Sephardim. Meaning the Jews that had stayed from the time of the destruction were just Jews. They were the Jews who were, they weren't Sephardim, they weren't Ashkenazim, they were the Jews who were there from the time of the destruction. But now there was this major influx, major is numbering in thousands and maybe tens of thousands, but not more than that, in Tzfat and in Yerushalayim. And now it's this Sephardic community that settles into the land of Israel, and it is almost exclusively Sephardic until the late 1700s. In the late 1700s, the Ashkenazim begin to arrive, and they arrive in the late 1700s from two diverse camps, but what they shared was a religious and mystical motivation, and that was the coming of Mashiach. The two groups are the Hasidim and the Misnagdim. The Hasidim, of course, we're familiar with, founded by the Baal Shem Tov, and the Misnagdim were primarily the students of the Vilna Gaon, who were, Misnagdim means to be opposed to. They were the ones, groups opposed to the Hasidim. We've spoken about this at length in the past as well. These two groups of Jews literally fought tooth and nail about the soul, over the soul of the Jewish people, the Misnagdim. Those who were opposed to the Hasidim believed that the early Hasidim were going to destroy Judaism, that they had become almost an idolatrous sect. They had changed too much and were too focused on belief in the Rebbe rather than belief and praying straight to Hashem. Our Hasidim today, this is just worth noting, are very, very different than the original Hasidim, as is the case in many, many movements when there's significant opposition to any movement. I spoke about this last week as well with the Muslim movement. When there's a very strong opposition to any movement, what it does is it draws the movement back towards the center and just incorporates many of the positives and cuts away the extraneous things that really can't survive the test of the opposition. And so Hasidus went through that. And what we see today is more or less, if you change the dress, the gap between a chassid and a non-chassid, you know, there are gaps, there's no question about it. I'm not denying that. But it's less than what it was, far less. The Vilna Gaon, for example, forbade his followers to marry a chassid because he believed you were marrying out of the religion. That's how strong it was. But anyway, these two different groups, the Hasidim and the Misnagdim, both arrive in the land of Israel in the late 1700s, and they were both driven by messianic feelings that it's time to, what so to speak, force the hand of heaven. Now again, just a little historical context. At a certain point, you know, the Jews were exiled, and the exile just goes on and on and on, and it doesn't seem like there's ever an end. What's going to happen that's ever going to change the status quo? How many hundreds of years do we go through this exile? And there was this sense of what's known in Hasidic works as the Isarusa Dilatasa. We have to inspire or arouse from Dilatasa, means down here, and that will cause an arousal up in heaven. Meaning, we can be the cause down here, if we'll take the first step, that will, so to speak, force God's hand to hasten the coming of Mashiach. The Hasidim, of course, were led by the Baal Shem Tov, who himself tried to make it to the land of Israel, but he never succeeded. He was quoted as having said from heaven, they stopped him from being able to come. One thing happened to another. He wasn't able to make it. There was a legend that they say about the Baal Shem Tov trying to get to Israel. He was stopped by a group of bandits along the way, as travel in those days was filled with such episodes. And he tried to bribe them. He offered them a half of his share in the world to come if they would take him and escort him to the land of Israel. As the legend goes, as I say many times, the legends we have are, they say a lot about the person who the legend is about. Can't verify whether or not that did or did not actually happen. In any case, the Reb Baal Shem Tov never made it. Does not make it to the land of Israel, but his brother-in-law, Reb Gershom Kitover, does arrive. Baal Shem Tov married Reb Gershom's sister in around the year 1742. So mid-1700s, we now have from Ashkenaz Hasidim coming to the land of Israel. And he obviously came with a group of families and followers. He originally lands in Hebron. And then by 1753, we find him already founding one of the first Ashkenazic communities in Yerushalayim. So this is now 250 years after the expulsion from Spain and Portugal, 250 years of Sephardic presence in Yerushalayim and in Tzfat, and now we have, in the late mid-1750s, the first Ashkenazic community is being founded. Rav Nachman of Breslov, another of the Hasidim, will make an appearance about 40, 50 years later, in the late 1700s. He does not stay long. He eventually returns to Uman, as many are familiar with, where Rav Nachman is buried, but the legends of his presence in the land of Israel and stories about him in the land of Israel like spread throughout the Hasidic world, and that was a big draw as well, and Hebron becomes a strong Lubavitch community. The Hebron community will, of course, go through many tragedies along the way, but in the late 1700s, it became a strong Lubavitch Hasidic community. So there, the Hasidim begin to come. The Misnagdim, as I mentioned, the students of the Vilna Gaon, who, I don't know if it's not coincidentally, but similar to the Baal Shem Tov, he himself did not make it. He also set out on the journey to go to the land of Israel and did not make it. We have records of him attempting to go and records that he never made it and turned back. But, you know, again, and I just stress this, these are the Ramban, the Vilna Gaon, the Baal Shem Tov. The desire to return to the land of Israel has preceded the concept of the term Zionism. This is an old, from Avram Avinu, the desire to go back. But his students, Rabbi Menachem and Rabbi Yisrael of Shklov, they both did make it to the land of Israel with their families and followers in the early 1800s, and they begin now a Misnagdish, a community, Ashkenaz community, in the land of Israel. Now, again, despite the fact that Misnagdim and the Hasidim were at each other's throats in Europe, in Israel, they were so small and life was so difficult, it bonded them together. These two groups, which couldn't get along in Europe, but in the new land, in the homeland of Israel, found a way to become one Ashkenaz community while they were there. These early years, let's say from around 1750 to 1850, these 100 years was a very difficult time for those who arrived in the land of Israel. I've quoted Rabbi Wein before as saying it was pretty much a place to go to die. That's what the land, there was no economy. It was not a place to raise children. Schools were just, you didn't have the systems that you needed to raise a family. So there were a few Jews who were the real pioneers who went and established communities, but it was small in number. And if anything, people would go there as they were aged, older. If they wanted to die, being buried in the land of Israel is a tremendous merit, as discussed in the words of the sages many, many, many times. So people would go there in those days. Today we live in a day, in an era where after 120 years, if a person desires to be buried in Israel, so they could live their life wherever they want in the exile, and it costs a few $1,000s, you could be flown and buried in Israel. You don't have to go there. In those days, you were buried where you died. There just wasn't an option to do anything other than that. So if a person desired to be buried in Israel, they wouldn't move there at the end of their life, and that's where they would die. These groups of Jews, in these hundreds of years, in the 100 years, 1715, 1850, are motivated. They sense it's, we can do something. We could force God's hand. We could begin to build the community and bring the Messiah. Had a tremendous amount of determination and persistence, just the tenacity that was necessary, is very hard to describe what life was like. And this is, of course, not to take anything away from the chalutzim of the early 1900s. We've all seen pictures and black and whites and short videos. Not to take anything away from what the early settlers did in the early 1900s, just to say there was 150 years of Jewish community in the land of Israel as we began to come back even before that. Travel through Europe in 1750 to 1850, not simple at all. They arrive in a new climate, new disease, no economy, lack of food, and all of these Ashkenazim now have to deal with a new antagonist, that being the Arabs. The Ashkenazi Jews arriving, they've been dealing with the Russian Tsar and the Christians and all of the problems that plagued Jewish history in Europe throughout the years, which, you know, an enemy that you know is an enemy you can deal with. And they arrive in the land of Israel, and it's under the Ottomans. And for most of these Ashkenazi Jews, this is a whole new world of addressing all the challenges that exist, where all of a sudden the Jews arrive, just like today, just on, it was on a much smaller scale. Why are you here? Well, we believe this is our homeland, and you're dealing with the Ottomans. The Ottoman Turks are in control, and they've been in control for several hundred years, and probably don't appreciate anyone coming and saying, this is our homeland. And that was a very difficult period of time, obviously. The stories that are told of clearing rocks, again, this we're familiar with from the Chalutzim. It was a land that was inhospitable. It required so much work just to be able to get anything out of it. There were specific events which were disastrous. For example, there was a cholera epidemic in Tzfat in 1816, which was shortly followed thereafter by an earthquake, literally destroyed the city and took hundreds and hundreds of lives. Just as an example, this Reb Yisrael Shklov, which I mentioned, a student of the Vilna Gaon, who settled in Tzfat, wrote a sefer called the Pas HaShulchan, literally means the bread of the table. And it's a takeoff of the Shulchan Aruch. The Reb Yosef Cairo wrote the major book, the major work on Jewish law, called the Shulchan Aruch, which means the set table, which was the term he used for, I'm going to lay out in front of you everything that you need. So several hundred years later, he wrote that in the 1500s. So Rabbi Yisrael Shklov now returns to the land of Israel, and he wrote what's called the Pas HaShulchan, the bread of the table, which was a work on the agricultural halacha, which had not been practiced in literally hundreds and hundreds of years, because the land of Israel has its own unique series of agricultural laws. It's not even included in the Shulchan Aruch. You can't find these laws in the book of Jewish law because it wasn't relevant to the Jews living in Europe. So he set out to write a monumental work which became, this is in the early 1800s, which would become the centerpiece of today in Israel. This is already dealt with for 200 years. But this was the first work bringing up to date with all the agricultural things going on, the laws that were needed, which would be followed by about 50, 60 years later, parenthetically, Rabbi Chil Michal Epstein, who wrote a sefer called the Orach HaShulchan, which was an abridged version of a book of Jewish law. So he wrote, and again, Rabbi Chil Michal dies in 1908, so he's writing in the late 1800s, Orach HaShulchan HaAsid, the future book of law that we need, in which he's addressing all the laws that are going to be in existence when the Jews return to the land of Israel, agriculture, the Beit HaMikdash, the Sanhedrin, the High Court. These works were being written. It was being addressed because the Jews were beginning to trickle back and it was becoming relevant. But in any case, what I wanted to share was that Rabbi Yisrael, who wrote again the Pas HaShulchan, the bread of the table, in Tzfat, in his introduction, writes about Yisurei Eretz Yisrael, the suffering of settling the land of Israel. The Gemara, which he notes, the Talmud says, Shlosha Dvarim, three things are acquired only with Yisur. And you can only acquire three things through hard work, through suffering, through difficulty. The three things are the land of Israel, Torah, and Olam Haba. You can't acquire those three things if you don't put in the effort, and it's going to come at a cost to acquire those three things. They're not free, so to speak, the Talmud says. So the land of Israel is one of the things that can only be acquired through Yisur, through difficulty. So he writes that in the cholera epidemic of 1816, I think it was, if I have the date correct, yeah, 1816. So he wrote that he lost his wife and all of his children but one to cholera. His entire family was wiped out, his wife and all of his children, and one daughter survived. And then that daughter was killed in the earthquake that happened shortly thereafter. And he literally writes how he had to flee to Yerushalayim with nothing. And you're right, I had manuscripts, I have nothing but the shirt on my back as I flee from Tzfat to move now to Yerushalayim. And so I mentioned just as there was a level of personal suffering and difficulty that the Jews that were there, which is just unimaginable, in the era that they are in. There was a strange quirk in history that Rabbi Wein points out, Rabbi Vera Wein, that the Turks agreed to. Now, the Turks were known as the old man of, the sick man of Europe. They were like teetering on being toppled for a long time, as empires are wont to do. It took a long time for them to build up what they had, and then they got sick, so to speak, and until it actually fell apart at the end of the First World War. They agreed with the European powers due to the holy nature of Palestine, and probably also due to the fact that they didn't want to be responsible, that the foreign nationals that would come to live in Palestine would be under the protection of their original government. Meaning that the Turks said, if a Jew from Russia moves to Jerusalem, we're not responsible for him. Now, partly that was done to say, like, it's an international area, so you're on your own, and therefore we're not responsible. We don't want Russia being angry at us if their citizens are murdered by marauding bands of so it's under the Russians' problem if you come. Now, for whatever the reasons why they did that, what that created was a rather odd quirk in history, because the Russian Jew who immigrated to Israel became protected by the Russian consul, so to speak, in Jerusalem. When he lived in Russia, he was persecuted without end. But now that he's in Palestine, the Russians were most interested in having a foothold, as is today the same story as was many years ago. So the Jew who moves is now protected by the same government that could care less about him when he was back home. And the same was true for the French and the English and the German. All of these Ashkenazi Jews who make their way to Palestine are actually given protection by those original governments. The local Svardim, who have been there for 300 years, are persecuted by the Turks the same way they had been for 300 years. And this created a very odd balance that the newcomer Ashkenazim actually were in a more honored, protective, and had the ability to flourish to whatever extent they could more than their much longer tenured Svardic neighbor who remained under Turkish control and was persecuted as such. Helps explain some of the dynamics that were there. The Turks themselves had all sorts of problems. They were conquered by Egypt in 1831, and then there was a peasant revolution, and it brought it back to the Turks. There's turmoil in the Ottoman Empire, and meanwhile, while all is going on, the Jews during this time slowly trickle in. I just want to share with you. You could look this up on Wikipedia. It's hilarious in some ways. Between the years 1838 and 1876. If you look up population of Jerusalem, so on Wikipedia, they will report 18 different census reports that were taken between those, so 40 years or so, just under 40 years. Now they have 18 that actually have information. Sometimes they didn't, there were Jews, Arabs, and Christians living in Jerusalem at the time, so they don't always have full information. 18 years from different places, all sorts of different reports. Some are official Ottoman, some are from British Observer, some are from this one, from that one. Reports of the population in Yerushalayim. The total population ranges from 11,000 to 36,000. This is again between the years 1838, 1876. Just as a point of reference, the city of Hampstead, or the town of Hampstead, if that's whichever the right way to say it, has approximately 7,000 to 8,000 people in it. And Côte Saint-Luc has about 35,000. Those are the numbers today. If I have the numbers correct when I moved in, that's what I remember people telling me. So, like, that's what we're talking about. The total population of Yerushalayim is somewhere between 11,000 and 36,000 during those 40 years. Of the 18 different censuses that we have the reports of, 9 of them report that the Muslims were in the majority. 9 of them show that the Jews were in the majority, and the range as to how much were in the majority shifts back and forth to whether or not the Jews were in a majority by 6,000-7,000 more, whether or not the Muslims were. So what do we know about that time? We know nothing. All we know is that it was clearly not clear who had the majority. Depending on who was doing the census and what agenda they had, we clearly get different numbers. We know there's around 30,000, give or take, people in Yerushalayim, and it's somewhat split between the Muslims and the Jews. Beginning in 1882, which is the first wave of Aliyah, as it's defined, the first official Aliyah in 1882, which follows, we'll talk about that, the first wave in a subsequent class more in depth, but in that, that's when the Russian pogroms then really kicked off a mass immigration. 15 to 25,000 Jews come in that first 1882, 1883. Beginning then, until 1967, so within the next 80 years, the population of Yerushalayim will explode to over 260,000 people. We go from about, again, 36,000 in 1876, 1967, a little bit less than 100 years later, we're at 260,000 residents of Yerushalayim. And beginning in 1882, there will never again be a census that puts the Muslims in the majority. When the Jews begin to come in 1882, it's a clear Jewish majority in Yerushalayim, with nearly 200,000 of the 260,000 by 1967. And we're double the number of Arabs very shortly after 1882. So the shift in Yerushalayim, again, always with Jews there, but it was a very small community, even in the 1500s when the exiles from Spain and Portugal came, several hundred, maybe 1,000 or so Jews in Yerushalayim, maybe. And that number stays around all the way through the 1800s, in which even in the censuses that had us in the majority, we were 8,000, 9,000, 10,000. Beginning in 1882, that explodes and gets us to where we are today is, you know, well more than that. But again, by 1967, 200,000 Jews are in Yerushalayim. It's hard to know what the validity of the census, but in 1850 as a whole, there were about 350,000 residents, with only about 14,000, about Jews in 1850. How did these Jews, survive? How did they manage during this time? So it was actually impossible for them to support themselves. It just wasn't something. There wasn't the economy. They didn't have the ability to farm. They didn't know what they were doing. It wasn't feasible. Rabbi Wein jokes, and I quote him often. I apologize. I'm not sure if I even have to apologize for that, but he's my Rebbe again in Jewish history. Jokes that it was divinely inspired that the land of Israel should not be able to self-sustain until the redemption happens. Because if it were true that you can earn a good and easy living in Israel, like, what would we still be doing here? Everybody would be back. And it's not right. The time isn't there for the full redemption yet. So God has ordained, so to speak, that you cannot survive there either. And again, we're looking back, 2020, things have even just 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago was vastly more difficult than it is today. I'm not saying it's easy today, but that's the way that it's been. It's been a difficult way, and that began from the very, very beginning. Again, he concluded his little, a pun on that existence, that the land of Israel and eventually the state of Israel became the single greatest schnorring apparatus in all of Jewish history. The amount of funds that have been funneled in to Israel to keep the Jews alive there over the last, let's say, 200 years, it makes it the single greatest fundraising apparatus that's ever existed in the Jewish world. Maybe the world as a whole, but I don't know if we can say that. He quoted a story from Milton Friedman, who was a Nobel Prize economist. here in the States. In the States, who was invited by the Israeli government to study their economy and see, like, you know, what they can do, how they can improve. So the story goes, he did his report, he reads through all of their numbers, and eventually comes back to them and says, this doesn't make any sense. Your numbers are so far off. It's like one thing to run a deficit budget, but you can't possibly survive on the numbers that you're showing. He sits him down and he says, what are you hiding? This can't work. I know you're hiding something. He said, no, we're not hiding anything, but you should just know that every organization does fundraising. They go to the States, they go here. This one, it's like there's an entire underground economy that exists in which individuals and institutions and the government all go out to raise funds to be able to make this thing work. So he said, well, you know, what do you want from me? All the books that I've written, and that doesn't apply to a normal functioning country. I can't help you but that's how we function, and that's how, in a way, we continue to function. It's of note, I remember we pointed this out when the hurricane in Houston took place a couple years back. It made the news that the Israeli government sent $1 million to aid the recovery effort to the Jewish community of Houston. It's a big deal, because that was the symbolic switch in which money has funneled in a one-way direction since, again, the early 1800s. It has been the diaspora taking care of the Jews in Israel. And that move in which the Israelis sent funds to the States to help them was this seismic shift in how the balance of power is. And it's a big deal. It is a big deal as we continue rolling towards our full redemption, just to see Israel becoming the state of Israel, the modern land of Israel becoming what it is. In any case, in those days, we were very far from any money going out of the land of Israel. It was a one-directional funneling. Money went from outside in. It was known as the Chalukah. Chalukah means the division. There was a tzedakah organization. It was basically called the Kupas Rabbi Meir Bal Hanes, which was taken after the great sage from the Talmud, Rabbi Meir. And there were yellow pushkas throughout Europe. Every home had a yellow pushka, and they would collect, pennies would be collected in every home. Every home would give their pennies to the local Rav, the little town, the little shtetl with 50, 80 families. The local Rav would collect from his 50, 80 families and go to the next bigger town, who would go to the next bigger town. Eventually, it'd end up in the big towns throughout Europe, and those Rabbanim would get the money to the land of Israel. Once it would get to the land of Israel, it would be divided there amongst all the different families and organizations in Israel. So that the entire Europe was basically funneling money to the land of Israel. This was an entirely illegal operation. In almost every country in Europe, sending money to a foreign country, particularly to the Ottoman Turks, who were at war in one way or another with most of the other countries, so you're sending money to an enemy country, was completely illegal, and almost every single Rav throughout Europe was liable to be arrested at any given time, which was a dangerous way to live because people have enemies. But that's the way that it worked. It was a terrible system, not just because of the fact that every Jew living in their home country was doing something illegal, which most of the times was fine, but was always something that was in the back of your mind. But it was an intrinsically problematic and unfair way of dividing up money. Now the money comes in. So you can just imagine who's in charge of dividing that up. How do you figure out which organization is more important? Everybody thinks their organization is the most important. Without us, nothing can happen. This family is more important. This family is bigger, more prominent. You can just imagine the problems that this created. So what eventually happened was every group created their own mini Kupas Rabbi Meir Bal Hanes. The Hungarians sent to the Hungarians, and the Russians sent to the Russians, and the Germans sent to the Germans, and then the Hasidim had, and the Misnagdim had. Everybody tried to do it, but that was the system. It was known as the Chalukah, and it was simply the way that the Jews in Israel during this time period were able to survive. Sir Moses Montefiore, one of the heroes of the Jewish people in the early days, arrives in Palestine in 1839. And he is dedicated to promoting Jewish growth, that we can stand on our own, that the Jews that were there would have what they need to self-support. And he came not just wealthy on his own, but he was also the executor of an American Jew by the name of Judah Turo, who many will note from many things named Turo in his memory. Judah Turo had left his estate and wanted it to be spent in Israel, and appointed Sir Moses Montefiore to be his executor. And so he comes and he's going to start spending money to help the Jews become self-sufficient. One of the most famous things that he did that you all have seen, and those of you who have had the privilege to be in Yerushalayim, is the famous windmill that he built in Yerushalayim right outside the walls of the old cities in the late 1850s, with a very simple plan of, let's build a windmill, they'll be able to grind their own wheat into flour, they'll be able to support themselves. It works everywhere else in Europe, which of course is a great plan, except we all know already that nothing works in Israel the way that it works everywhere else in the rest of the world. So it was actually, unfortunately, a pretty big failure as a plan of a windmill. There were roughly 20 days a year with enough wind for it actually to be strong enough, because the wheat in that grew in the land of Israel was a tougher breed than that which was in Europe. It just didn't really work. I'm sure there's a lot of symbolism in the idea of not having enough wind to be able to crush the tough wheat of the land of Israel, and the meaning that behind that, but we'll leave that. He built a printing press and a textile factory, pouring a lot of money in to be able to support the Jews. He begins to buy land as well outside of Yerushalayim. Mishkanot Sha'ananim becomes the very first settlement outside of the wall of the old city in 1860. Again, so we're in that time period where the Jews are beginning to trickle in. This is still before the first wave of 1882, and which was eventually renamed Yamin Moshe after Sir Moses Montefiore. No one would stay there at night. There are many stories. You can go there now if you go on a walking tour. They'll tell you all about it. How the Arabs, the local Arabs, it just wasn't a safe place to spend the night. So the Jews would go there during the day. They would open up shops and businesses, but it did not become a residential area because nobody would stay. They would go back into the old city walls and live there. And that remained that way for almost 20 years until Nachalat Shiva, the inheritance of the seven, which was named in 1879, of the first seven families who created a settlement and were able to actually live there. They stayed outside of the walls of the old city, which eventually they developed the Mea Shearim, and many of the other neighborhoods outside. This is now the beginning of the development of Yerushalayim. Again, we're in the late 1800s, where the Jews are now not only in the walled city, at a clear majority of the old city are Jews, but now already beginning to expand outside of the walls. The Navi, in the Navi of Ezra and Nehemiah, describe in a prophecy of the rebuilding of what it was like building the second Beit HaMikdash when the Jews return, how they would build with a shield in one arm and bricks and mortar in the other, how they needed to defend themselves from the attacks while at the same time trying to lay the bricks. And that's literally what the Jews were doing at this point in time as well, trying to build up these communities and being afraid, literally, for their lives. In the background of all of this, we get to our topic for tonight. Then we're finishing up with this, it's already been a while. The Chov of Eitz Zion. The Chov of Eitz Zion begins to take hold in the 1860s. The idea that we need to support these Jews. The Jews that have come, they've been there now for a while. It was the late 1700s, remember, that the Hasidim and the students of the Vilna Gaon begin trickling in. It's a steady trickle throughout these 1800s. We already have Sir Moses Montefiore in 1839 beginning to build land, building the windmills, setting up these communities. And many of the other things that we have been learning about. So in the 1860s, or throughout Europe, the idea takes hold that this is something that needs to be supported. The time is right. The Jews have come back. The Ottoman Empire is weak. And we need to support both new immigration, which also goes together with how bad things are in Europe. And it did not begin as an official movement as much as just the inspiration of the people that the time has come to return, and that the Jews that are there are living in an unsustainable system. They have no means of support. And these groups, they were called again Chovevei Tzion, were a mixed bag, a strange mixed bag of supporters. There were very many pious rabbis who were part of this, Rav Shmuel Molliver, the Netziv. There were radical atheists, there were maskilim, who we learned about last week, the secular, enlightened Jews, yet Hasidim. It was simply the group of Jews who felt, we need to go home. And there were various reasons why the Jews felt they need to go home, and much of it was driven by a religious belief that the land belongs to us. It's our land, and we have the right to return. And we have the theological powers we mentioned before to force God's hand. And listen, now is as good as ever. The exile has gone on and on and on. Now is the time that we need to do it. This is already beginning in the 1860s. By 1881, again, the Russian pogroms will actually officially kick off the first Aliyah, in which we'll have nearly 25,000 Jews come, which was an unheard of number at that time. And this is in the years prior to that. Couple of points. The religious philosopher behind it was a Rav by the name of Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. Big Talmud Chacham. If you look him up, you'll see a picture of him. Huge kippah on his head, long white beard, the most traditional looking religious Jew you can imagine in Prussia. And he was a well-published Talmud Chacham. On Shulchan Aruch he wrote, on Chumash he wrote a parish on the Haggadah. And he publishes in 1862, this is well before the first Zionist Congress, he publishes a sefer called Drishat Zion. Drishat Zion comes from Seek Out Zion, or the Seeking Out of Zion, which is a takeoff of the phrase of Zion Ein Dorish Lo, which the Navi cries, no one is seeking out Zion. So he wrote a book, no, we are, Drishat Zion, and he laid forth the following philosophy, that salvation, the redemption, which has been promised us by all of the prophets, can only come about in a natural way. We need to do this. We've been waiting around, like waiting. When is Mashiach going to show up? No! Enough waiting. We need to make this happen. This is a religious Jew writing in the 1860s. We need to do this. And the way that we're going to do that is the immigration to Israel. It's time to go home. He argued in Halacha that it was permitted to bring korbanot, to bring sacrifices in Yerushalayim, which is a major, major halachic discussion, well before his time. Already the Rambam, Maimonides in the 1100s already, is very involved in such a discussion on various passages of the Talmud and understanding if the Jews, it wasn't relevant, the Jews weren't there. But he said, we need to go back, and we can actually go back and bring various offerings. This has to do a lot with the idea of the sanctity of the land of Israel, the sanctity of Yerushalayim, the sanctity of the place of the Beis HaMikdash. The discussion that we have today still about is a Jew allowed to go onto the Temple Mount, which is a big discussion, the many different parties and ideas about that. It all centers on this idea of, is it still considered so sanctified that we could actually bring a sacrifice? So he argued, yes, you can. And he said, there's no future for the Jews in Russia, which he was a man ahead of his time, 100% correct, all that was going to be brought within the 100 years from the time that he said that. Now, not only did he produce that philosophy of we need to do this on our own with an immigration, he then had his book was a call to action. And he said, we need to raise money, we need to buy and cultivate land in Israel, and we need to found, he wanted to found an agricultural school, be it in Israel or France, to train young Jews how to be farmers. It's an amazing thing, historically speaking, that in 1862, this was coming out of the religious camp. That's what we need to do. We need to learn how to be farmers again. We need to be ready to go back and buy and cultivate the land. It was the Mikveh Yisrael, which is a agricultural school which existed in Tel Aviv, was founded in 1870. It still exists. You could see where it is today. Was built off of this call of, we're going to do this. We are going to become farmers and buy up the land. And he added one more thing, that we need to form a Jewish military guard for the security of the colony. We need to protect ourselves. The Jews that are there, they're afraid to live in their homes that they're building outside of the wall. We need to produce an army to protect them. That was all coming from the religious camp. Meanwhile, at the same time, there were two secular books which had a great influence on this Chovav Etzion, those lovers of Zion, these organizations that began. Moses Hess was a German philosopher, wrote a book called Rome and Jerusalem. And it wasn't about Rome, ancient Rome. It was about, he wrote, look, what's going on in Rome today? It had been broken down into so many different factions, and they unified themselves. Just like they found a way to come together and unify, we can do this as well. And he also put forth a plan for the Jews to come back to Israel. A secular book, it was not religious. And Leon Pinsker wrote a book called The Auto-Emancipation, which was again also a secular book about how we can control our own destiny and bring about, wasn't redemption, just bring about a return to the homeland. And these groups were actually brought together by Leon Pinsker, officially in the early 1880s, into the name the Chovevei Tzion, to support the return of the Jews under all of these different ideas. And again, what it did is it took all of these different streams that were beginning to form of moving back, of getting things together into one single organization. That organization only lasts until the first Zionist Congress in the early 1900s. And then that basically everything gets taken over by that and everything merges in. So it only had a short official existence, but it was the product of all the years before it of this idea of the Jewish return. Now, the idea of the Jewish return did not come without opposition, like all good movements have. And the opposition also came from all sides. The Reform movement, which was taking hold in Germany, was very opposed to it because of their nationalistic bent of, we're Germans. Are you a German Jew or a Jewish German? So the Reform movement was, we are Germans. That's who we are. And the idea of wanting to go back somewhere else was antithetical to the belief of their nationalistic approach. They actually removed Jerusalem from all, there are no references to Jerusalem in their Siddur. Interesting to note, historically speaking, that's come back. The Reform movement has had a major shift. When you learn history and you just see how movements take time and what happens, but in the beginning they removed all of that, and a lot of that has actually come back. But anyway, they're very opposed to the Chovevei Tzion movement of the support of to set up our own Jewish army and military and to learn how to be agricultural farmers in the land of Israel and to raise money to send to Israel and to support immigration to Israel. Wasn't part of their program at all. The religious parties were also opposed to it. Even Reb Shamsh and Rafael Hirsch in Germany actually agreed with the reformists that he was fighting, that this was a bad idea. And the religious Jews had different reasons for being opposed to it, which were primarily two. Number one is that there were too many seculars who were involved, and therefore the movement itself was losing its sense of religious redemptive quality. It was becoming a secular, irreligious group. And number two, the whole idea of forcing God's hand that we can move redemption along is not a simple idea and was not agreed upon by Jews. When we'll speak at length about the idea of Zionism, there are many passages in the Talmud that has great debate over many, many years whether or not we are allowed or not allowed to do this. Are we allowed to can we return en masse, or are we supposed to wait? There were many, many Jewish camps, still till today, who believe it's our job in the exile to wait. It's our job to sit here. We're not just here because it's not the right time for me to move. Not just, I don't know how I'd make a living. I have other, it's not because I can't come up with a good enough reason to go. It's because I'm not supposed to go. My job in exile is to wait until Mashiach comes to bring me home. That's an approach. There are different approaches. So many were opposed to this original movement. We live in a day and an age. It's, you know, we're blessed to live in the era that we live in, where the state of Israel has existed for over 70 years. This movement back has existed for over 100 years. So history sometimes, you know, answers itself. The questions that were burning questions in the 1940s, are you allowed to go back? Can we go back? Can we set up a state? Those are irrelevant debates to us, where the state exists. The state is, as I started tonight with, is so powerful, is so feared in the Arab worlds that when something, as I started, like, happens and they say, who else has the ability to do this? So we live in a day and age where that's the reality of the state of Israel. I think we're just at about half of the world Jewish population has returned home. So we don't have those debates. Of is it theologically allowed to move back to Israel? I don't remember ever being at a Shabbos table where that was still being debated of is it appropriate to go back? It's a question of course, half the world Jewish population is back. It's home. We're back in control. What an amazing thing. Is it right for me to go back? Maybe yes, maybe no. We're all still here. So the answer we've all answered is basically no. But it's not a theological debate where we sit down. How many of us would say the reason why I don't move to Israel is because I'm philosophically opposed to it? I never heard anyone say that. But we're not there for other reasons. But in those days, this was a theological, philosophical debate. And that was the opposition that they had. What eventually, of course, happens is the secularists do, in fact, completely take over the movement. This movement, which was the Netziv, I didn't even really share much, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, was one of the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin, the great Yeshiva of Volozhin. The Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin was a member of the Chovavei Tzion. It's like hard to exactly express what that means. The pinnacle of Jewish religious Talmudic scholarship was a member of this movement because it had religious connotations and religious Jews were part of it. But it was eventually taken over by the secularists. When Herzl begins the World Zionist Congress, all of the Chovavei Tzion basically join into that, and the idea of it being a religious movement falls by the wayside. Now, historically speaking, the significance of that, we'll talk about what happened because of that. But what began as with some religious undertones did not have that when the actual Zionist movement begins. And then, of course, it will come back. There'll be such a thing called religious Zionists. But the original movement becomes a very secular movement, and all of the religious aspects basically fall by the wayside because it becomes something that they really can't be part of, not because they were philosophically opposed to it, for returning to the land. Returning to the land, again, is a very Jewish idea, but because it wasn't an organization that they were part of. Last thing for tonight needs to be mentioned, the Baron Edmund Rothschild, who passed away in 1934. He was one of the French Jewish members of the massive Rothschild banking family, many of whom were in England. He was from the French side. In Israel, he's simply known as the Baron Rothschild. But in the world, there were many Baron Rothschild. If you just Google Baron Rothschild, there were several long families, but in Israel, Baron Edmund Rothschild is the Baron Rothschild. He was a philanthropist and who looked for opportunities to give, and he had a meeting with this Rabbi Shmuel Molliver, who was again one of the other religious Jews, big Talmidei Chachamim, who were part of the Chovavei Tzion. And Rav Shmuel Molliver has a meeting with the Baron Edmund Rothschild and convinces him of this momentous historical opportunity in the late 1800s that we can reshape the land and buy the land and settle the land. And the Jews are coming back again. This is before Zionism was a name. We can grab the moment. And Edmund Rothschild is taken by this. And it becomes his life's work to settle and develop the land of Israel. In Hebrew, he's known as HaNediv HaYedua, the great benefactor of the land. It's estimated that he spent more than $50 million before he died in the land of Israel, which I looked up. I just plugged in, you know, today. What is $50 million? I chose the day of his death, 1934. $50 million in 1934 is today over $973 million in today's value in terms of what he pumped into the land of Israel. Rishon LeZion, Zichron Yaakov, Petach Tikva, Binyamina. The Carmel Winery was founded by him. And in order to found the Carmel Winery, he founded the first Jewish factory, which produced wine bottles, amongst many, many, many other things that he was involved with. His name, the Rothschild name, is everywhere in the land in Israel. Upon his death, he left a note, a last will and testament of sorts, in which he writes, "I have great thanks to the Almighty that I was given the privilege of participating in helping the Jewish people return to their ancient homeland and have even begun to see the fruits of my labor in my own lifetime." His children, after his death, purchased and financed the Knesset in his honor. In the Knesset today, there is a room downstairs that is dedicated to the Baron Rothschild and all of his many accomplishments in the land of Israel. And that is some of the background of the Chovavei Tzion, the groups that began before the Zionist movement takes hold, the return of the Jewish people's inner yearning to come home, to resettle, to return. And as things get bad in Europe, they come in droves. That's what we're going to learn about Mirtz Hashem. We'll talk about many other events. I think we're going to be the Dreyfus Affair, I believe, is the next thing that we'll talk about Mirtz Hashem next week. As we begin to this laying the groundwork, all the things that we'll talk about from the late now 1800s to 1948, I'm really going to get to the end of the First World War again this winter. That is the plan, really, just to talk about some of these ideas that went on during this time period, which I personally find just fascinating and great information that that we should be familiar with, and appreciate those who really did all of that work in laying the groundwork and sacrificed so much to be able to do so. So that's it for this evening.